It is now my very distinct pleasure to introduce our speaker for this morning, Dr. Margot Hurlburt. Dr. Hurlburt is the Canada Research Chair on Climate Change and Energy and Sustainable Policy. She is, as I understand, currently teaching with the University of Regina as in the Department of Political Science and working with the Johnson Shoyama Institute on public policy. Dr. Hurlburt is a professor of science and innovation policy at the Johnson Shoyama Graduate School of Public Policy. She comes to us today as a settler woman living in Treaty 4 territory. She will share with us what she has learned as an ally doing research with Indigenous people for the purposes of advancing water security. Again, welcome, Margot, and I'll turn the mic over to you.
Great, thank you, and thank you to the Unitarian Center, some old friends and acquaintances that I've known for quite a while, and to new friends that are here today. I'm going to speak somewhat about my journey. I didn't want to jump right into advancing Indigenous water security, but I thought it appropriate to start with how I arrived here in my research and frame to my work with Indigenous water security and the rest of my work on climate change and water, because it's important in the sense of why I do what I do and how I do what I do. So I did prepare a PowerPoint presentation that we should get running, so it'll keep me on track. I know we have maybe about half an hour, and I have three sections I'm going to speak to, leaving the very good stuff on Indigenous water security to the end. And I'd take questions at the end of each of these three sections instead of just at the end of the presentation, because they're so different. So, my journey here, I'm a lawyer, a recovering lawyer. And I worked in private practice for 17 years, and I worked at SAS Power managing their legal department. And that's where I completed my master's in constitutional law and water. Water was my focus, and Indigenous water rights. It was kind of an oxymoron working there and advancing Indigenous water rights. So I took another excessive pay cut and went to the university and took a tenured track job because I was a master's in law teaching in justice studies. And I haven't looked back since 2005. I completed my PhD in Amsterdam on social and behavioral sciences and got my Canada Research Chair in 2016. And my goal is to solve climate change, basically. So I have this cross-interdisciplinary research program, which is very unique in the sense that I do both climate adaptation, so how we're going to respond to water crisis, floods and droughts, but I also do mitigation, which is how we're going to reduce our greenhouse gases. And that's quite unusual in the science sphere to do both and try and unite those. And I have a journey through justice and my legal career and being from Saskatchewan in relation to advancing justice and Indigenous justice. So next slide. I'm going to talk a little bit about that journey. So I was honored in 2017 to be appointed as a coordinating lead author in the Land and Climate Report to the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. These are the scientists that go through several rounds of peer review to be appointed to this position through the Canadian government and then the International IPCC Forum and write these special reports or the assessment cycle. We just finished the sixth assessment cycle that came out last year. And this, for me, was confirming but also ground shaking to actually think about land and climate change, adaptation and mitigation all together with another 300 scientists that all had a very deep specialization in one of the topics in relation to how climate is changing, our water is changing, our relationship is changing with land, water, and climate change. And even though we didn't get water in the title, it really was about the water cycle and floods, droughts, food security, which depends with agriculture on water. And putting it all together in one spot and thinking about it and how we're going to solve climate change, both reducing greenhouse gases as well as adapting to floods and droughts in the future and feeding the world, was just so important to me that it's really kind of shaped my research platform. So next slide, please. So this is from the sixth assessment report, and it really shows the dire straits that we are moving into the future. We are already in warming, especially in Canada. We're already 4 to 6 degrees warming above pre-industrial times, right? So when we do these global assessments, we're actually in Canada worse off than what these slides are showing. We're actually at a point where we're 1.2 degrees warming above pre-industrial. And you'll know our Paris commitments are to keep it well below 1.5, approaching 1. So in this day of 2024, we're already at 1.2. So to say 1.5, we know when we're writing the IPCC assessment reports, we're going to overshoot 1.5, probably 2 this century. So we're well past what I'm showing you. But the IPCC is very conservative. So it will show you these trajectories. And because of, as you, most of us are my age, know the political backlash the IPCC has taken over the years, they're actually quite conservative. More conservative than the climate change climatology scientists who will tell you we're on a trajectory towards 4 to 6, right? And we're trying to bring it back by the end of this century to bring it back into a 1.1. And so we put together these risk diagrams which show you just drought, taking that as an example. At 1.5, we're going to have droughts that are 2 times the intensity and frequency of what we have experienced in the past. But with global warming of 4 degrees, that's going to be 4.1. So we're moving to a drier future and a riskier future in relation to water. And it looks like it's contradictory in that we're going to have more precipitation if you're covering the precipitation, but we're going to get it in a different time of year, and it's going to come very quickly and go very quickly. So we end up with more drying and drought and water that runs through our rivers and runs through our agricultural fields at the wrong time of the year, like in the winter, with winter rain instead of winter snow. Next slide. So we also know in the science field that's not talked about a lot is that we can actually attribute droughts to human-induced climate change with a lot of specificity, so that Williams in Nature Climate Change can conclude that 42% of this mega drought we've been in Western North America is directly attributable to this greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which is something that's just evolved in the climate change science in the last few years, this ability to attribute it to the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere from human activity. Next slide. And we know that we're going to have more flooding because the rain is going to come in the winters. We're going to have earlier floods with spring snow melt and these extreme precipitation events that are starting to be experienced around the world. Next slide. Okay. So Risks, adaptation, and vulnerability are the focus of my research, and risks to our human systems and our human and ecological systems. Next slide. So in that relation, the project that allows me to pursue the work on adaptation is funded by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada, and it's called Bridging the Water Adaptation Gap, and it is about adapting to drought and floods in South America, four countries there, Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile, and then the fourth country, sorry, is Canada, and we're on the same El Niño La Niña weather system with South America. So we actually have a lot of comparability with these countries, and they're also semi-arid, dry agricultural lands. So right now, the project is continuing work to figure out how we're going to adapt into the future. And they have very similar systems to ours: irrigated agriculture, expanding irrigation, semi-arid agriculture, indigenous marginalized populations, and some very big agribusiness. So there's a lot of comparability and a lot of interesting diversity in water governance. So Chile is a water market. Argentina is an old, ancient Spanish water system. And, of course, we all know Canada. And Uruguay is a lot like Canada and a government-regulated water system. Next slide, please. So with water, it's important that we have all of the interests in water if we're going to solve water adaptation and water crisis involved in the discussion. So for the Social Science and Humanities Research Council, the idea of building a partnership between the South American countries and Canada was worthy of funding for them. So we compete for funding based on our pitch, and all of these agencies I have listed on this slide banded together to say, yes, we need to have discussions through academia about the water crisis and climate change, droughts and floods, and mitigation as well, into the future. Next slide. So we put together in our project these objectives that I'm not going to go through, but about how are we going to determine risk into the future. We've got some great infographics I showed you about drought getting twice as bad and precipitation, right? But how do we actually operationalize these things that we know are going to happen in our systems? So if we have a quarter of the water coming down the South Saskatchewan River from Alberta, what are we going to do in Saskatchewan and Manitoba in the future in relation to water? How are we going to allocate that one quarter water for Saskatchewan and Manitoba's needs into the future? And we can only solve this by getting everybody together in the same room and thinking about it and talking about it proactively. So we have these project governance as well that we set up with the four countries, each feeding into a science plan, and we also ensured that we had an indigenous component, and this has been a journey for me as well. So we have, working with indigenous people, an indigenous research team, which includes Angelina Weeney from First Nations University of Canada, another couple scholars that work exclusively with indigenous people, and it works separately, yet together, with the partnership of people talking about water, which adds some really interesting diversity challenges, and really is important to the work going forward. So the Fowl Hills Tribal Council participates with all of those partners of governments, non-government institutions, and then we also work with one First Nation community on water and how to build capacity and work in relation to water security in the future. So it's part of, but it's also not part of, our entire project. Next slide. So indigenous knowledge versus Western science knowledge, and I'm just going to kind of put this out as one of those feelers. Indigenous knowledge is, I'm sure you're all aware of it, it's very narrowing, it's very reductionist, it's very dominated by the natural and physical sciences, and it's akin to doing experiments in labs, which are controlling every variable. And of course, indigenous knowledge is quite different. It's quite inclusive, it's relational and cooperative and very peaceful. So I've kind of done a journey of where I've got to. Is there any questions at this point? I showed a lot of IPCC stuff just to ground it, which is maybe a bit scary. Usually I get some really good questions on the IPCC stuff. Yes?
On the page you showed us with about 25 details of things, there's a lot of thinking going on there. And it's hard not to jump in the weeds because you think, well, okay, flood control. So, I mean, if I think of, say, Alberta's irrigation systems and canals, I mean, what is that? How does that work? Or does it work? And also, why are we getting only a quarter of the water if there's lots of flooding going on in the Old Man, like sort of rivers? So there's a lot of detail there. I'm not sure my question is, except are you going to talk more about some of the decisions based on those 20 so points?
Were the 20 so points the institutions that are participating, or was it the objective figure with 8?
They talked about flood control, and they talked about all kinds of stuff. But there were.
Oh, it was the flood slide.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the flood side. Yeah. Okay, great, thanks. So the question is about flooding in the Old Man River, and is it specific to this year, 2024? And what's going on?
I don't know. Maybe I think I'm not an engineer or anything, but I mean, I think about, there's so many detailed issues there, and you're talking about the administration of your project.
Mm.
And I'm, okay, I'll wait for you to tie it together.
No, I love the question. And I think it's really important. So I gotta tell you, I'm presenting to the Prairie Provinces Water Board on Tuesday on governance. It's not this presentation at all. But they do exactly what you're talking about. These are the, and if you don't know what they are, there's an apportionment agreement that's signed between Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and the federal government on who gets the water coming down the South Saskatchewan River and the percentages. And the federal and provincial governments set up a board called the Prairie Provinces Water Board that oversees this treaty, although it's provinces and federal government. So we actually have governance institutions that oversee the quantity of water coming through the provinces and have agreements on that quantity of water. And the federal government, it's their jurisdiction, but it's one of the cooperative initiatives that happens in Canada and the provinces that nobody really hears about. We see a lot of politics where they're all fighting, but there's actually a lot of water bureaucrats that are part of those partners that work on these issues, meeting every couple months. So there's, I call them bureaucrats. They're water, deeply technical water experts that are governed by the treaty that says Saskatchewan gets 50% of the water coming down that river, and then Manitoba, right? So when it becomes flooding, that's a different issue. We actually learned a lot previously in the 2014 and 2016 were wet years, and we flooded Manitoba and the United States. And we learned a lot through these institutions about warnings, giving warnings, our water is coming down, when it's coming down, the timing, et cetera, et cetera. So there, Canada has a very good institutional setup to handle both emergencies and day-to-day, year-to-year management of water. That's not to say that in the future, they're going to be able to continue to do such a good job. So even this year, you will see Alberta is meeting to determine how to allocate their water because they're going to have a shortfall in the South Saskatchewan for their irrigators. Saskatchewan, we're not having these meetings, We don't use our full allocation. That's part of the reason. We're building our irrigation. Okay. So it's a great question on the flooding. And right now everybody's eye is on drought because we're in a 4 or 5 year drought happening here. But we should never lose track of the issue of flooding. And that's why our dams are there. The project, what's beautiful about working as an academic is it's academic. So I'm outside of the political. I know there's political. I acknowledge there's political. But if you can work on flooding in a time of drought, you'll have a better plan than if you're in the midst of responding to a crisis trying to build your plan. And it's the same. Last time we did a project 8 years ago, it was in a time of flooding, and we were trying to develop a drought plan. Well, we couldn't get much attention to the drought plan because flooding is such a crisis. But they tie together. And the reality going forward, if we're going to be smart, is they should tie together. So in the flooding years, I was saying to the irrigators in Alberta, well, why don't you store water for times of drought? And the engineers laughed me off the podium because they're made for drainage. As you said, their lines are made for drainage. But you will actually find they're starting to talk more about, well, we need to plan our infrastructure, our irrigation for both droughts and floods. So the mindset is changing of people. So it's really important. Good question. Thanks. Okay, so I'm going to... Oh, yes.
How is it measured or monitored? How do you know when each province has got its share of the allocation? I'm just trying to see. The water begins up north in Alberta. How do you measure to make sure that Manitoba gets it?
Yeah, and that's actually an excellent question. It sounds easy. It's not easy. So they actually measure the snowpack and the water that's going to be coming down. They estimate it. And the 50% comes through, but it's balanced on the year. So that what that tells you is they're even though it sounds like the science should be easy, it's not so easy because Alberta could give us the water in January and December, and it's not much use to us in January and December. We want it in June and July. So this is where what sounds like a pretty easy quantitative method in the practice becomes quite challenging. But, oh, and to answer the question, the federal government has stations along the rivers and scientists that actually do this moment to moment, week to week, day to day. It's really quite impressive. That I find very impressive, and the Canadian Drought Monitor. If you go online and Google Canadian Drought Monitor, wonderful, wonderful information for people, right there at your fingertips. It's live, like almost real-time updated information. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears, and I'm going to talk about that kind of difficulty where I was showing you Indigenous people participate. They're part of this, but it's a challenge. It's a challenge to advance justice in a big project like this, because not all of the scientists or the partners share the same approach to doing Indigenous work or working with Indigenous people. So it sounds like it's a little out of place, but really people acknowledged here, we're all treaty people, and we all have treaty privilege, and it's just figuring out... For some reason, I'm going this way. I think so I can see the slide. Figuring out our treaty privilege. Next slide. I can do this better. Okay. So many of us in this room are Saskatchewanians, and for me, it's been a journey. So my grandfather homesteaded in northern Saskatchewan starting in about 1920. Next slide. And he was a terrible farmer, but he was here to be a farmer. But what my father did is he wrote his memoirs a few years ago. And in it, he wrote down the history of what happened. And his language was Indians camped on my grandfather's land in the winter. Next slide. And in actuality, what he wrote was a story about how my grandfather had Indians camping on his land, and he learned to hunt from these Indians. So he wrote this story about how the Indians taught my grandfather how to hunt, and some great stories about how that actually evolved and the details around it. And next slide, about how my grandfather, of course, was an Indian, so he wasn't supposed to be hunting out of season, so he would have to take the meat and hide it in the woodpile. So that's why I'm showing you the woodpile. And my grandfather was not a good farmer, so this is how my father's family survived through those years of the Depression, was because he was hunting with the Indians. But it was a long journey for me to get to the place where I would check my language about the Indians camping on my grandfather's land. Right? So really, my grandfather was camping on the Indians' land, on the First Nations land, like the language that my father wrote, and then the language that I've had this journey through, not recently, but my time in, at first of all with my, at SAS Power, and then my time teaching injustice studies and thinking about colonialism and the language that we use to describe our history. But I do have to say, I'm not sure my relatives would appreciate me saying my grandfather camped on the First Nations land. So my aunt wouldn't talk to me after my land and climate report. I wrote that we should eat less meat in the summary for policymakers. And I was on radio talking about eating less meat. She wouldn't talk to me for a couple years. So I'm not sure that my family would really weather this that well. So next slide. So I was not there with the indigenous people camping on their land. By that time, they had not been allowed anymore to live in their traditional way on their traditional land. They had been moved to the reserves. But the stories are now written down for my children and their children. Next slide. So what is my white treaty privilege? So my family owns property. We've all got post-secondary education. And my stories, which I'm running out of time, so I can't tell you, my father's best friend was Eagle Feather, who was another four-year-old boy when my father was 4 years old. And they played and they hunted and they did everything together. And my father, who became a education administration professor at the university for 25 years, he failed grade one and two because he was never at school because he was playing with Eagle Feather. So the question is, we don't know where Eagle Feather went. We don't know his, what would have been his Canadian name. We've completely lost track, right, of the First Nation people whose land was my grandfather's. So what happened to him is the question. Next slide. Okay, so part of that journey for me is understanding this difficult place of Indigenous knowledge and Western knowledge. So we know the climate is changing. We know it's real, it's happening, our risks are increasing. But including Indigenous people in research is not appropriate, right? The inclusion idea that having Indigenous people participate with 25 partners that you saw that are federal governments, the Saskatchewan Chamber of Commerce, et cetera, is not always an appropriate way of hearing, documenting, and advancing Indigenous justice. So how do we do that within these projects in a way that really makes a difference? So some of my colleagues and I have other research projects and relationships, and one of them's with Star Blanket First Nation, which is the smallest First Nation, I understand, the smallest reserve in Canada, and it's had a drinking water advisory for, I'm going to get this wrong, but for decades, right? They have not had clean drinking water. So they're indicative of many of the First Nations in Canada that have these challenges. So we're interested in water and advancing water security. So although I showed you my 8 objectives of my research that's SHRC funded, it's not appropriate when we're trying to learn from Indigenous people to bring our 8 objectives into the community as researchers and in a European fashion start doing research as I would in Melfort, where we're going to work with agricultural producers about drought, right? It's just absolutely not appropriate. It's a completely different relationship and one that we've been in now for about 3 years with Star Blanket about learning about water security. So next slide. So we learned that water is medicine. To Indigenous people, their health is directly linked to the health of waters. So this is written by the Star Blanket Indigenous people. We were there, was it last weekend? 2 weekends ago, doing a water walk. And this is really quite, it's just moving to go participate there with Elder Ethel and the people at Star Blanket about water and what it meant to them. It's without it, there isn't life. When water breaks, and they talk about women, and we carry children in our wombs, they are within the water, right? And the birth is when the water breaks is what they're referring to, and there is life. It's their first medicine, their sacred protocols around water that the Indigenous people practice. So when we go to have a water walk and talk about water with the Star Blanket Reserve people, they practice those traditions on their territory and with us. It's memory, it's sacred, and everything is connected. So for the Indigenous people, it's relational, right? So bringing the biologist in to talk about water quality would not be an appropriate method to engage with Indigenous people. So we actually, after talking to the Star Bank, they were concerned about their water on their property, and I said, well, why don't we just get it tested? So we got a Saskatchewan Research Council kit, went out there and tested the water in their sloughs, and sure enough, it's got this huge E. coli reading. So we sent it back to Saskatoon to the lab, and within a day I was getting like panic calls on my phone. I'm teaching, and every 2 minutes this call's coming in, and it's Saskatchewan Research Council tested the water from Star Blanket, and it's so bad they're concerned people are drinking it. So they're trying to get a hold of me because I ordered it to make sure nobody's drinking the water. So it was quite illuminating to the First Nations on Star Blanket that their sloughs or their wetlands, there's a language thing again, I just am pointing out to you, their wetlands are full of E. coli, right? Farmers, we call it sloughs. First Nations people, it's wetlands, right? So if I say the slough's full of E. coli, that sounds, well, yeah, what do you expect? If I say the wetlands are full of E. coli, we're concerned. So our language is so important. Next slide. So I think I was asked here to speak because you'll see Elder Ethel, Elder Sharon, and some of my research partners. We've started writing about our experiences and talking about what we're learning from the First Nations on reserve. So their words and their language is in these articles. Next slide. And I've shared some of it here with you. So this is kind of what we put together, and it tells you we learned about the E. coli together. So I had some of the Saskatchewan Research Council and then some of the biologists talking to the community about E. coli and what it means. And this was so illuminating to me because it was the scientists doing science talk and then the First Nations and people in the community wanting to know answers in plain language. And one of the meetings, it was just So the Qu'Appelle chains are polluted. We know they're polluted. We know it's municipal waste and it's agriculture runoff. We know that. We've known this for 40 years. To hear a scientist say, well, we'd have to test the water in the Qu'Appelle and figure out from the testing, you know, which agriculture activity and pesticide or herbicide, to give that response to, you know, communities, any community on the Qu'Appelle chain, I find it a bit not a good faith, let's say, because it just tells me we need more science. We know our water is polluted. So I think working with First Nations that are really concerned about this when they learn about it and want to know, like, have it tested now on their property and solved today is really important for moving not just Indigenous water security into the future, but water security for all of us in the Qu'Appelle chains and along the South Saskatchewan, the Saskatchewan River. So I'm almost out of time, but one other point I want to make about advancing Indigenous water security. I love going for the day to Star Blanket, but true learning, I have found, it doesn't usually happen over a day. It's a journey. And learning about Indigenous land-based practices, too, really has to happen on the land with Indigenous people and elders teaching it and teaching it with their own language. So I've used a couple examples of language, sloughs, wetlands, right? Just thinking about the language we're using and the language Indigenous people are using, and in fact, Indigenous Cree or Indigenous Dene language versus English is so illuminating that it does change your relational view of the world. So attending, if you can ever attend a land-based learning camp run by Indigenous people, they're usually 3 days, 4 days, but you'll learn moose skinning, hides, making clothing, fishing, and medicinal plants. All these types of things can really... I was already writing my Justice Decolonial piece, but to actually go do this is a bit life-changing. So I'll tell you one story and then I'll finish. So I went on this land-based camp a few years ago, and we did the medicinal walk, and the elder was showing us the plants, and one really good one that you'd put in a tea and it would drain your lymph nodes. I thought, great, you know, I want to do that. So I go outside my cabin. I'm looking for this plant. Can't see it. So I go up to the Indigenous elder and I say, you know, I was looking for that plant by my cabin. Couldn't find a one of them. You said they were all over. And she goes, well, did you do an offering of tobacco? And I went, oh, no. So there you are, you know, typical white settler woman in an Indigenous camp, and my view of learning is, okay, where's that plant? I'm going to make some tea. You got to hear and practice the whole gamut of Indigenous knowledge and learning to really appreciate and grasp the relational learning that the Indigenous people are sharing with you. Okay, so there I am. I think I'm on time. Any questions?
Given our vulnerability to drought in Saskatchewan, particularly as I assume in years to come, the glaciers will be lessened and the snowpack less, and there'll be less and less water to Saskatchewan, why are so many people in Saskatchewan so resistant to paying the carbon tax, which is trying to have an impact on this matter? It seems to be backwards.
Yeah. I can answer, and I'd actually appreciate if anybody else has an opinion on this to, you know, weigh in on this. Okay? Because this is, yeah. So, two reasons in Saskatchewan, major reasons. Not only Saskatchewanians, but many people, tax is just a problem. It's a taxation, the whole idea of a tax, if we could call it something else, then they might not have such an issue with it. Taxation for many is just an issue. Having another tax or being taxed something so the price goes up. It's against their political worldview or view. That's my thinking, because I've met, and I'm sure you all have, if you go down to Texas and talk to somebody about a tax, like, you'll just be blown away how evil taxation is. And we have people of that ilk in Saskatchewan for sure. And then the second one is, and not just in Saskatchewan, but in the Midwest of North America, we have many climate deniers. Shocking. Shocking as it is. So having a carbon tax is an issue. And we've seen this. You all know that the municipalities, was it rural municipalities? Voted, passed some resolution against anything to do with greenhouse carbon dioxide or carbon at all, right? So I don't have to tell you that. I was supposed to speak in Swift Current last year for municipalities on climate change, and we got so many threats we had to move it to online. And then I got barraged on the chat by climate deniers. So, yeah, it's a problem. It's gotten better over the years, I have to tell you, though. But there's still, in some areas and venues, and I guess I say it's gotten better, so when I speak publicly, I have less people in the crowd. I used to always get one or two that we had to talk about climate change as a science for at least 10 or 20 minutes, right? And I don't get that. But then I'm worried that it's because we have bifurcated. I'm speaking to always people that are environmental, that believe in climate change. And the people that don't believe in climate change don't attend our events anymore. They're off having their own events, right? So I worry that that's what's happened. Yeah. Yeah. And if anybody else has an idea why, and it's not just Saskatchewan, I don't want to. Yes.
Okay, so actually a couple of things. You know, I personally am kind of at middle ground about the whole taxes thing. I try to understand both sides. But I know in my family, like, you know, my mom and stepdad and my nan and papa, they'll kind of for taxes because of reasons, like, I'm guessing the whole, like, helps with things like water and other things. But then my dad and stepmom and a lot of people, like my dad's friends and family, they're against taxes, you know, they're Trudeau haters and stuff. Because, you know, my dad says that what he doesn't like is this idea that he should have to pay a whole bunch just to leave his house. Of course, someone like me may sometimes say, well, you can just walk. But, of course, where he goes, he's often leaving the city and going far away. So the just walk would take a lot of time. So, with a bunch of other things, like other health things. So, you know, a bunch of my dad's friends who, like, live on farms, they're having to, like, pay for to do stuff with their land, I understand. So with stuff like that, they don't like having to pay for that extra money for it. They don't like having to pay taxes just to have, you know, say, like, their heater or air conditioning working, or do stuff with their land, leave their house, that kind of stuff. So they think it's unfair and don't like it. And so some of it's that. And also, there's actually this one guy I like to watch on YouTube, and what he's actually said is, now, I don't know if this is true. You guys can take everything I'm about to say with a grain of salt, but what this guy says is that actually, apparently, not even just people who access to pay taxes, but the bank and all of those people, you know, we think they're, like, you know, doing all this good stuff, but according to this guy, they're actually secretly just trying to take our money from us, and we're fold us knowing it, the planet, the money system is being rammed by child murderers, is what this guy says.
Thank you for that. So some really good points, and people don't like carbon tax, and people can't afford, is kind of too what I heard. People can't afford taxes. So that's another reason. And there's somebody at the back there. Oh, and here, Justin.
I'm wondering, given the the lateness of the hour, if we can make this the final question.
Okay, and we can talk after. I'll still be here. I'm not leaving.
Actually, I'm pro-carbon tax, because, or whatever you want to call it, because the whole idea was for us to use less fuel. And just using the Qu'Appelle Lakes, Katepwa, seeing the motorboats and platoons, are they called? The amount of gas and filth and chemicals put into those lakes are quite disturbing. So I figure if you have to pay a little more, maybe you'll use a little less, and I think that was the whole concept behind it.
Yeah.
So I'm...
Electric vehicles and electric boats.
Yes.
But then we need clean electricity. Another
yes.
discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, we got some questions online. I think Jamie said that was the last question, though. So you could put your question in the chat, and they'll email it to me, and I can chat. Or,
well, I think that the world has become a lot too much money-centric, where we forget the purpose of money. Money as a balancing tool to be able to distribute resources or to distribute our energy. We forget that instead of asking for more money, we need to go outside and do the work ourselves without the money involved. Because money is just a metric to balance things. But we do have the power to use less water, use less fuel. But if we think that we need money to achieve everything, then nothing is going to be achievable with this idea.
Thank you, Justin.
Good way. Thank you very, very much. I can tell that the discussion would go on, and our renters would likely be ushering us out. It is certainly a measure of the success of the morning, and I thank you very, very much, Margot, for coming.